Hello and welcome to CSDS Asia Matters, the podcast where we aim to go behind the headlines to discuss the major issues facing the world's most fascinating region. I'm Andrew People. On the show this time, I'm pleased to be joined by Josh Kalancic. Josh is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he has a new book out entitled Beijing's Global Media Offensive, China's Uneven Campaign to Influence Asia and the World. Josh, it's really great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Not at all. Josh, obviously the book's title tells us a lot about the subject matter that we're dealing with. But to start with, could you tell us how you got interested in this area and just flesh out the main arguments that you're trying to make in the book?
Sure. Well, I got interested because I had written a book 15 years earlier called Charm Offensive that looked at how China was becoming more effective at that time and using soft power. At that time, China was not as powerful in terms of harder military or economic power. And I wanted to sort of see where China was at this time in terms of using soft power, state media, and cultural diplomacy and other tools at a time when it was actually now really, really powerful overall and potentially causing great worry in other countries. It then spiraled into looking into other ways of China's influence. So the book became not just a book about media, although it's media is in the title, but a book about how China, for the first time in decades, is really assertively trying to wield influence within other countries' domestic politics and societies. That's the first argument. The second is that I talk about the ways in which they're doing so, or were trying to do so before COVID leveled them. And those are using the big state media outlets, taking control of local Chinese media outlets, using information and disinformation online, getting control of what I call the pipes of information, like internet cables and the actual internet in some countries, and what I call old-fashioned influence, like paying politicians, such as what's happened in Australia and other places, using techniques to gain control of Chinese student groups or Chinese diaspora groups in many countries, and using techniques to coerce businesses and politicians in a range of countries. So that's the second argument, the way that they've done so. And then my third argument is looking at whether that's been successful. When I started out, I thought China was being quite successful in some of these influence efforts. And what I, even before zero COVID really dealt a blow both to China domestically and to China's image in the world, what I was finding was that China was had only a really mixed record in a lot of these influence efforts. Some had succeeded, but others had failed miserably and actually had driven extensive blowback against China. And in some cases, particularly in wealthy liberal democracies, legislation designed, although not said to be designed just to rebut Chinese influence, interference, was and is mostly designed to rebut Chinese and to some extent Russian influence and interference.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you call it an uneven campaign in the book's title. Let's talk a bit more about those successes and failures if we can. Maybe first of all, let's talk about where you see China's efforts as not being so successful to date. Where is it failing in this media offensive?
So what I argue in the book is that the three major big Chinese state media outlets, CGTN, CRI, and Xinhua, CGTN and CRI, which China poured money into in the last decade, and for a time hired quite a few quality reporters, and I think tried to make them like Al Jazeera. That was perhaps their goal. You know, a media outlet based in an authoritarian state, but one that outside of a few discrete issues related to Qatar produces quality reporting. That didn't really work, in part because China is not Qatar and virtually any story could touch on China, and partly because as this was going on, China became much, much, much more authoritarian. And so CGTN and CRI's stories are turgid and propagandistic, and most of the quality journalists they hired quit. Xinhua, by contrast, which produces stories that are wire stories, which by their necessity are somewhat dry anyway, I think has been a success. It signed content sharing agreements with a huge number of media outlets all over the world. Xinhua is cheaper than the other major news wires. Sometimes it is free, And as a result, it's attractive, especially in developing countries where news outlets don't have a lot of money. So I think Xinhua has been successful. It's being picked up more. I think the long-term danger of that is Xinhua is just viewed as another newswire like Bloomberg, Reuters, the Associated Press, Kyoto, etc. And this has already happened in places like Thailand, and people just picking up newspapers or looking online and seeing stories from Xinhua. And obviously, Xinhua's coverage of China is not accurate or fair. It's a state-owned entity without the controls, guarantees of editorial independence that exist for, say, other state-owned newswires like Agence France-Presse, or it's not a newswire, but United States' Voice of America.
Just for non-journalists, Josh, can you explain a bit what Xinhua is and why a newswire is so important in the sort of media ecosystem, as it were?
Yeah, sure. So newswires are places where they produce essentially almost exclusively breaking news. So the major newswires around the world are the Associated Press, Reuters, Bloomberg, Agence France-Presse, Xinhua, Kyoto, which is Japan's newswires, and then there's a spattering of others. And they try to get to the story first and report the story quickly and get it out there to the world. That's their main goal, not necessarily producing the best quality writing, or they don't do a ton of features in general. And the reason that they're really important is that first draft of a story, I actually worked for a French newswire over 20 years ago now, that first draft of the story often winds up defining some aspects of the story. And information that is in that first draft is often repeated by other news outlets, and especially repeated now online. It doesn't necessarily mean that 2 days down the road, the New York Times might, debunk that information. But at first, you have a whole spread of information from the first news wire to gather the information. That's really, really a powerful position. And were Xinhua to be the one defining that position, that's an incredibly powerful position to be in, to define and shape the contours of an emerging news story, and having other major news outlets, at least at the beginning, not repeating verbatim what you said, but let's say there's an explosion in a major Chinese-funded project in Pakistan, and Xinhua is there first. The reporters landing there from, The Guardian or the New York Times or whatever, and especially from news outlets from developing countries, they have to get their bearings, etc., if it's not a Pakistani outlet, and they're going to be inclined to rely on the information that's already out there, and that puts Xinhua in a very potentially powerful position if they become widely accepted as a legitimate source and used widely. The third thing I was going to say is, in terms of the old-fashioned influenced efforts, particularly the direct paying of politicians, that has not been very successful. I mean, it might have been successful in the short run, but it's been caught in multiple places. And I think that and China's efforts to control campus dialogue have been major, major factors, as well as China's support for Putin in the Ukraine war, in what is now China's worst global image virtually everywhere in the world in decades.
You referenced Al Jazeera earlier, Josh, and obviously on balance that's probably been a success story for Qatar in terms of its image and so on and so forth. What's China trying to achieve with its efforts, this media offensive, as you call it? Is it about improving China's image, or is it more than that? Is it trying to persuade audiences in other countries of China's point of view on various global issues, for example?
I think China has had several goals. For one, China's leaders have chafed for decades at this idea that China lacks quote-unquote discourse power to go along with its increasing economic, military, and other power, and that global narratives both about China and about the world in general, of which China is the second most powerful country in the world, were and are mostly set by media outlets based in liberal democracies in Asia and those in Western Europe and in North America. And so I think they wanted to have an outlets that could also get their say in there, get sort of China's say in there, even though the New York Times is by far, you know, it's not getting the United States' say in there. In fact, the New York Times and other outlets were harshly critical of the prior president. And when the current president's approval ratings were in the toilet, they reported that and et cetera. But I don't think Chinese leaders necessarily understand that. But generally, global narratives are shaped by those outlets in liberal democracies. And China wanted the ability to push back at that discourse from liberal democracies' media outlets and to have their own say, their own big outlet that would transmit sort of China's views on a range of issues, and so that China would enjoy discourse power akin to that of leading democracies around the world. I mean, I think secondly, they wanted the ability, especially by spreading Xinhua and through some of these other efforts, like de facto taking control of the Chinese language media in most countries, to just censor, straight out censor or force self-censorship about the issues that are reflect really, really poorly on China. And those include rights abuses, Xinjiang, the takeover of Hong Kong and destruction of rights, the zero COVID policy, you know, we could go down a long list. Third, I think what they wanted was, if we're just talking about media and information, an ability to spread China's model of the internet, of a kind of walled garden internet. And China has increasingly done so along with Russia in places like Southeast Asia and Africa, and has pushed this idea at major internet organizations, including those linked to the UN.
I guess in the West, when we talk about authoritarian countries like China and Russia trying to have an influence over the media, we think about it, for example, in terms of the Russian efforts to influence the US elections in recent years. But I'd like to drill into what you found in your research about what Chinese interests are doing in this sphere, in Southeast Asia in particular. Can you talk about what you found in your research, particularly in Thailand, which I think is a country that you know particularly well?
Sure. I think that there was a sharp learning curve. I don't think that compared to Russia, which had been meddling in elections, not only in North America, but in Western Europe for much longer than China, and had gained an ability to use online tools to genuinely identify organic problems within countries and then use its bots and other tools to magnify those problems. So an example of that would be like genuinely magnifying racial tensions in the US or magnifying geographic tensions in Italy, etc. And also Russia had become a direct financier of some parties in Europe, for example. Most places in Southeast Asia, China has not become that sophisticated. They tried to do more of that in Malaysia's 2018 elections. It failed, probably rebounded against them. They specifically tried to back the KMT candidate, essentially, in the 2020 Taiwan presidential election. That completely failed for them and backfired. In Thailand, they've been more sophisticated. Thailand has always been the country in Southeast Asia with the warmest relations, or the mainland Southeast Asia with the warmest relations with China. And in Thailand, you have a creeping ability of China to influence politics and then probably in the long run elections. And they've done so through Xinhua has an enormous number of content sharing agreements there. They've done through very effective cultural diplomacy. They've done through trying to promote self-censorship about China. There's only really two independent publishing houses left, and there was a major effort recently by an ethnic Chinese tycoon to buy up one of them and probably close it. And I think that they have enjoyed close relations with the military parties there as the U.S. and other countries have sort of fallen off, even though Thailand is a U.S. treaty ally. They haven't gotten to the point like Russia had where they were funding, you know, like Le Pen's party, or where they were openly, you know, sort of providing clear political support to places. But I think that's probably coming in Thailand, especially if the military aligned parties win the election coming up this year. You will see a a much closer relationship, and then perhaps that sort of not just pro-China sentiment among politicians, but links where China sort of actively supports them. That is, sorry, just to not to be windy, but that is actually already happening in Cambodia. We didn't talk about Cambodia, where China is already essentially doing everything possible to support Hun Sen, including setting up their own China-backed media outlets in the country and supporting the main pro-Hun Sen media outlet and doing everything possible to sort of... Hun Sen is an authoritarian with little opponents anyway, but doing everything possible to make it easier for him to continue to remain in power.
So obviously, again, in the West, there's a lot of angst about, you know, how to deal with these sort of influence campaigns from places like Russia and China. So in these Asian capitals, I mean, obviously it depends on which country we're talking about, and you reference Cambodia there. But is there concern about Chinese media influence? Is there concern when they see Chinese companies buying up local media or Xinhua doing these partnership agreements and other efforts that China's making? Or is there a more relaxed attitude? How are governments in general, I know it's hard to generalize, but how are they seeing this media offensive and how to respond to it?
So Southeast Asia isn't monolithic, although it's often viewed that way in sort of European and North American minds, unfortunately, maybe Japanese too. So there's a range, just like there's a range of countries who are views of China, like Singapore and Vietnam are extremely, extremely concerned about everything about China, whereas Thailand is much less so. And then you have countries that are already de facto Chinese satellites, where they're so indebted financially or diplomatically to China that they couldn't do anything anyway, like Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. So it's a mixed region. Certainly, there's definitely a high level of concern. And I would say the highest level of concern is in Singapore, which always has the highest level of concern about China. They actually have passed a foreign interference law, not only targeted at China, but certainly that was a factor. One of the problems with that is, unfortunately, because Singapore is not a full democracy, it's some sort of hybrid state, they could use that interference law to try to crack down on legitimate civil society organizations in Singapore that have nothing really to do with China and claim that they are being influenced by foreign actors. If they took money from, say, you know, a think tank in Europe or an NGO in the United States, et cetera. So there are problems with Singapore doing it, but they are obviously the most concerned. And then secondly, I think you would have, at the policymaker level, the Philippines and Malaysia. Even though Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has historically had a good relationship with China, China's media efforts in the Philippines, as well as China's uber-aggressive behavior in the South China Sea, which the Philippines is probably, and Vietnam are affected most by, has led Marcos to, somewhat surprisingly, build a quite warm relationship already with the United States, as well as to welcome help on kind of sussing out Chinese media influence, which again is surprising because Marcos Jr. won the presidential election in some part by a massive campaign of disinformation. And I think in Malaysia, the prior government and certainly now the Anwar government has a very high degree of concern about Chinese media influence. The Chinese language press in Malaysia is owned by a tycoon who is very strongly pro-Beijing. Chinese language readers are not getting independent, really good independent coverage of China. They're getting essentially propaganda. The concern dates back to the fact that China was doing everything possible to keep Najib Tun Razak, the former prime minister, in power, despite his massive, massive scandals. They even offered Najib to spy on Wall Street Journal reporters who were investigating him. So for all of those reasons, you know, I think in those three places, the level of concern is very, very high. It's also high in Vietnam too, but because Vietnam has the ability to censor and control its internet so much, which they learned from China, there's perhaps less concern. And then the other countries, some are just outright autocracies or failed states like Myanmar, Laos, and Cambodia. Thailand, less concerned. They have their own extremely harsh internet laws. And then Indonesia, it's hard to tell. I think there is some concern, but Indonesia itself is regressing democratically. President Jokowi isn't not really interested in foreign affairs in general. And so I think that's a factor in terms of how they respond to China.
We've talked quite a bit about traditional media, newspapers, news wires, television, and so on. But how sophisticated have China's efforts been to spread its influence via social media channels? Do you see evidence that Beijing's been making similar efforts in Asian countries to those that famously, you know, Russia's done in US politics? What did you find about social media and particularly what China's doing in Asia there?
Yeah, I think they are building that up. I should say, I know this is a podcast about Asia, but they're also doing it in Europe and increasingly in the United States. Both the FBI director, Ray, and the head of Britain's intelligence services have warned that China, not Russia, is the biggest long-term threat in terms of disinformation related to a whole range of things, denigrating democracy, but also elections in those two countries. And China was caught by all the major tech platforms doing Russian-style disinformation in the run-up to the United States' our recent 2022 midterm election. So it's spreading. But certainly, yes, in Asia, I think there is a very, very powerful effort to do that. Like I said, it was sort of clumsy and didn't work very well in 2019 in Hong Kong and in the Taiwanese presidential election because China's was still very propagandistic. They weren't good at having bots or other people who really seemed like genuine people, which Russia is very, very, very skilled at. And I think that it was easier for countries in the region to see the disinformation and other techniques that China was using online to meddle in elections. But in the last year or so, we've seen China become much more sophisticated. Some people argue that China is learning directly from Russia. Like, there have been a lot of meetings. The Intercept had an article about many of these meetings between Russia and China to talk about how to wield influence on the internet. It's an open question whether these meetings are actually like training sessions, I think, or they're just there talking about how both countries want to work together at global organizations to promote a closed internet. But either way, their level of sophistication of meddling has become much better. And don't forget that there's a very sizable number of people in Southeast Asia, in nearly every country, but particularly those with large Chinese-speaking populations like Malaysia, who rely on WeChat as their primary social media platform. And this is true actually in Australia too, among Chinese speakers, rather than some of these other platforms that, you know, are more independent. And WeChat is not only completely lacks encryption, and so the Chinese government could collect their data, but also is, you know, is not a platform that where you would be getting really any accurate information about China. And if you were, it would be shut down pretty quickly. So they have become much more successful. And we'll see what happens in the Thai elections, which are coming up. I think that would be a good test to see how much and to what extent China meddles. And if they're going to meddle, they'll meddle for the pro-military party, how good they are and how sophisticated they are at doing so. But definitely that is coming. And I think you will see a Russian level of sophistication, particularly in Southeast Asia, the region that China knows well and which has a huge number of Chinese speakers and readers. That's already almost there and is definitely coming.
That's fascinating. I was going to ask where you see this heading next and whether you see China maintaining this campaign, investing more. But it seems, as you say, that part of the effort is to become more sophisticated. But obviously China's suffered some pretty big public relations setbacks recently, obviously with its handling of COVID, the protests that we've seen in China recently. I mean, do you think it's going to be able to get its message across in these Asian countries? Ultimately, can China succeed in this campaign if the message behind it is something that other countries find difficult to accept?
No, I mean, I think this is all, remember, I wrote this book, mostly wrote this book before COVID and before Putin invaded Ukraine, et cetera. Although I was able, the publishers were very good about it, and I was able to get in the Ukraine war. I got in zero COVID. I got in a whole range of stuff. I think, no, right now, China's able to wield influence through disinformation, but these efforts at soft power have been dramatically undermined. The China model, the idea that China is more effective at sort of managerial governance than leading democracies, one which was pushed early in COVID, and frankly has been pushed for years by many European and American writers, I think. I'm not going to name names, but there's a prominent New York Times columnist who's written many columns like that and did write several in the early days of COVID. That managerial governance, the idea that China is better at managerial governance has been shattered because of zero COVID. Not necessarily because of the actual zero COVID lockdowns for a while, but because they didn't use the lockdowns to prepare, which is completely ludicrous. So the China model, which is part of sort of what they sell through their soft power, has been severely dented. Now, if they manage to escape COVID with all this scrambling and don't have, you know, a horrendous death toll, and they return to high growth, that will again bolster their soft power. But the combination of these 3 years of zero COVID plus total mismanagement, China's much more aggressive diplomacy, which I don't even think Xi Jinping is necessarily so in favor of. He has several times spoken out against it. And then also just the increasing use of economic coercion against a range of countries has alienated a lot of states. And so it's an open question, but I think China has proven adaptable in so many other challenges over the last 30 years that it would be a mistake to think that China can't, again, wield the level of influence it was wielding inside countries before COVID and can't wield more than that going down the road.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for all of those insights and for talking us through the book. I do urge all of you listening to the podcast to read the book if you can. It's an excellent primer into this area, packed full of information and examples of what Josh has been talking about during the podcast. So, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Josh. Thank you so much to Rebecca Bailey, the producer for CSDS Asia Matters. Thank you to Alexander Lestrange again for doing the music for us. And thank you most of all to you for listening. I hope you'll listen to us in future for other podcasts that we have planned. For now, though, goodbye.